Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Hello, folks. Welcome to Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. Welcome to the Feedback Show.
We're going to be talking about the Island of Dr. Moreau and your thoughts on it. So let's make like a mole man and dig right in.
Yeah, the Island of Dr. Moreau, part one. Jenny Richardson says, hooray, this is my favorite Pitch Black Manor track.
Ah.
She's talking about going down. I love that song as well. You have some new PBM brewing, don't you?
Yes, that song I played at the end of that episode was from Monster Classics, which, as always, is available on Bandcamp. And yes, we are going to have a new album out on September 1st, right when spooky season kicks off. You put the baby pools away and bring out the jack-o'-lanterns. Mark your calendars. That's when Pitch Black Manor strikes next.
I'm excited. Drix writes, we're just normal men. We're just innocent men. Get out of my head. It's been stuck in there for days.
The dog man in that clip. It's pure joy.
It's pure joy.
Reminds me of all the good things that happen on the internet. Eldritch Gollum writes, so excited that you guys are getting back to H.G. Wells and covering the Island of Dr. Moreau. I want to respond with a quote that immediately sprang to mind as a rejoinder to Chad's comment that unlike the previous two Wells novels you guys have covered, Dr. Moreau isn't really a wish fulfillment story since you, quote, haven't spent a lot of time wondering, what if I was able to make a guy out of a goat? To which I was reminded of this quote from Japanese cultural critic Toru Honda, who said, you can get a lot of pleasure from anthropomorphizing objects into cute characters. You can have a relationship with an object, but if it is in the shape of a girl, then there are more possibilities. A cat, for example, can be represented by a cute girl with cat ears and a tail. It's obvious that the cat girl phenomenon began with someone thinking, I wonder what a cat would be like if it were a human. Then all sorts of desires get wrapped up in that image. That's from the Mo Manifesto from 2014. And the comment concludes, considering the prominent role of the Panther Woman in Moreau, that seems especially relevant. You know, that quote is odd because it's saying you can't have a relationship with an object, but then it talks about a cat, which is I don't think of as an object. And I think you can have a relationship with a cat. You don't necessarily understand each other, but you don't have to make it into a cute girl. I mean, that does change the nature of the relationship, maybe.
Andrew Brown writes, great show. I really think Andrew is the key to the gravitas of the story. There's a lot going on in the themes of the story. Vivisection fears, often legitimate, were alive and well as the discussions around evolution. It's petty how these discussions are viewed now, and we should be much more understanding of fears and concerns.
Yeah, hopefully we didn't seem to be mocking the fears and concerns of the time, because I think they're very much alive even today.
Oh, yeah.
Nom Nom Daguerre writes, I listened to this on my drive to work this morning. A few hours later, I listened to it again at home with headphones. I regret listening to this and every episode in my car. Those subtle island sounds in the background, so awesome. Chef's kiss. Yeah, I never want to overwhelm the readings or discussion with scoring in SFX. I've done that in the past and didn't like it. But if you're driving, the ambient noise will probably overwhelm them. A listen on the headphones would reveal there's all kinds of things going on. So thanks for noticing.
Steve writes, Puma, and that's in reference to, this is something I never realized, is that English people say Puma.
Yeah, Puma, it's the liquid U.
In America, we say Puma.
We do. The liquid U is hard for us. The Puma's new tunic is totally tubular. Does that sound good, Steve?
I don't like it. Kate Sherrod writes, just last year, I read Sarah Cole's excellent biography on H.G. Wells, Inventing Tomorrow, H.G. Wells and the 20th Century, which is one of the best literary biographies I've read. I recommend it to anyone who wants to know more about this amazing man, whom I'll always picture as Malcolm McDowell. I will as well. Warning, though, I wound up feeling compelled to reread all of his novels in publication order as I did so, which was a big project, but time very well spent. So glad to see the gents tackling this one at last. I think Moreau got a bit of a renaissance when Sylvia Moreno-Garcia published her cool homage, The Daughter of Dr. Moreau, which I also highly recommend.
Oh, cool. I'm going to have to check that out. Yeah. Into the Island of Dr. Moreau, Part 2. Mark Simmons writes, lovely voice work by Mr. Lehman. The Sayer of the Law is very preacherly, and I enjoyed his grumpy Moreau. Speaking of the law, I'm getting ahead of the story a little bit, but my recollection is that, unlike most later adaptations, in Wells' version, this parody religion wasn't created by Moreau, but by the animal people themselves. Mm. It feels to me as if they're trying to give some kind of deeper meaning to their pointless suffering. We must have done something wrong. But surely that's not intended as a commentary on organized religion. And then there's a little smiley face. Looking forward to Moreau's mad scientist monologue in the next installment, which should be Lehman-tastic. And it was. We did, I think, incorrectly say that Moreau created the religion and then corrected ourselves in later episodes. Because that was a revelation to me as well. I made an assumption that he did it, but it sprung up on its own. That said, Moreau didn't mind using the religion to control the beast people.
Kate Sherrod writes again, I must confess that when I was much too young to be reading this book, but nonetheless reading the book because my elementary school librarian rocked, I interpreted the Speaker of the Law as an Eagle Man and furthermore envisioned him as Sam the Eagle of the Muppet fame. And now I want a full Muppet Moreau with Bunsen Honeydew in the title role with Beaker as Montgomery. Mm-hmm. Makes perfect sense to me.
Absolutely.
But who for Pendrick? Classically, it should have been done in the 1970s with somebody like Charles Grodin. But who now? Jason Momoa? And Ethan Cordry writes, I'll go with Michael Fassbender.
Muppet's Island of Dr. Moreau would be a great fake Muppet movie within a real Muppets movie. Like, maybe there's a segment where Uncle Deadly is pitching his ideas for new projects and they're all horrific and gory. Eldritch Gollum writes, so I had my comment for this week all lined up, and then Chad said that Prendick's assumption that Moreau was grafting animal parts onto people made more sense than what was actually going on, and Chris questioned this. So now I have to come to Chad's defense. Thank you. By pointing out that this kind of xenotransplantation was something that was actually going on during Wells' lifetime, though all the cases I'm about to mention post-date the publication of The Island of Dr. Moreau. Nevertheless, they should be considered real-life examples of the kind of mad science Dr. Moreau was doing. We're going to go ahead and read these examples because they're all fascinating. The first and most obscure is John R. Dedge. Dedge hailed from Georgia and graduated from the Southern Medical College in 1890 as a doctor of dental surgery. During this time, dentists were often employed by sideshows to file the teeth of geeks to make them appear more savage. Oh. Dedge, who had a taste for the theatrical, had a more ambitious plan, however, and in 1901 performed a non-consensual surgery on a black man named Calvin Bird, onto whom he grafted a pair of goat horns to his head.
Oh, my God.
Bird was just the first, however, as Dedge would go on to create at least three more goat men for various sideshows before his death. If you want to know more about Dedge, historian Robert Damon Schenck tells his whole story in his book, Mrs. Wakeman versus the Antichrist and Other Strange but True Tales from American History.
Oh, God, that's terrible.
It's horrible. Continues. More well-known than Dedge is Serge A. Voronoff, a French surgeon of Russian origin who gained fame for his practice of grafting the testicles of chimpanzees and baboons onto men as an anti-aging therapy while working in France in the 20s and 30s. Apparently, what? Voronoff originally used the testicles of executed criminals, but as these were harder to procure than those of apes and monkeys, he switched to the latter. Voronoff also transplanted the thyroid glands of chimpanzees to human teenagers suffering from thyroid deficiencies and the ovaries of monkeys into infertile women. David Hamilton book The Monkey Gland Affair from 1986 tells the whole story of Voronoff's pseudoscientific career. All I could think of while I was reading that is, isn't Bela Lugosi's character in Bride of the Monster Dr. Voronoff?
Oh, it is.
Yeah, so I think Ed Wood was drawing on some real history when he creating an atomic race of supermen. Finally, there is John R. Brinkley, who combines the best, or maybe worst, attributes of both Dedge and Voronoff, and so is perhaps rightly the most infamous. Brinkley was a native of North Carolina who had no formal medical training or education and acquired his credential as a doctor from a, quote, diploma mill with the amazing title of the Kansas City Eclectic Medical University. In October of 1917, Brinkley and his wife moved to Milford, Kansas after he spotted an ad in a newspaper saying the town needed a doctor. The following year, he opened a 16-room clinic and began treating local residents. One day, a patient came to him asking if he could fix a man who was sexually weak. Brinkley responded that the patient would have no problems if he had a pair of those buck or goat glands in you. The patient then begged Brinkley to try and graft the testicles of a goat onto him, which Brinkley did for $150.
Oh, God.
Soon after, Brinkley began to perform more operations to restore male virility through the transplanting of goat testicular glands onto male patients at a cost of $750 per operation. Price went up. Brinkley, who, remember, had no medical training whatsoever, often performed these operations while drunk and with instruments which had not been sterilized. As a result, an undetermined number of his patients died. There is a 2016 documentary about Brinkley by director Penny Lane with the appropriate title of Nuts! ! That is a lot of information, all of which is profoundly disturbing. Thank you for that comment.
Wow. Yeah, moving on. Anna Elizabeth writes, I think when pain is so callously inflicted, when humans lack empathy for suffering or of others, that is the most disturbing thing for me. Such is far too often encountered in life. Mm-hmm. And Leprawan writes, dudes, I know I'm older than you, so 80s music means something else to me than it means to you, but Oingo Boingo, No Spill Blood, was right there. To the House of Pain, indeed.
Yeah, a few folks brought that up over the month. In fact, Michelle Elbert commented on our extra credit episode that we had to turn in our Gen X cards and blazers for not mentioning No Spill Blood. I think I actually did see that, but forgot to put it in the notes. Believe it or not, I'm not a big Oingo Boingo fan.
I do believe it.
I mean, Weird Science is, of course, an awesome song.
Dead Man's Party? That's a
catchy song. But see, Dead Man's Party makes me mad because I make a lot of Halloween playlists, and it's like 7 minutes long.
Right.
You know, I get the point, but it's too long. Yeah. And the rest of their stuff, I'm just not that into. So sorry. Yeah. I will turn in my card, but not my blazer. You have to take that off my dead body.
Shoot. Oh, man. Hayden Orr writes, you guys mentioned some unexpected influence this book has had on pop culture in general over the years, but it's had a great many influences on the world of comics as well. There have been multiple straight adaptations of the story, the most recent of which was done by Ted Adams and Gabe Rodriguez, and is great, by the way. Moreau as a character has popped up in comics outside of his own story as well. He appears in Volume 2 of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, where Alan Moore implies he's an uncle of the painter Gustave Moreau. I remember that, yeah. And he shows up as a villain in the Hugh Jackman Van Helsing prequel comic.
Why, that's a deep cut.
Man, wow. And recently in the Weird West comic called West of Sundown. There was also a DC Elseworlds comic where the Justice League are all hybrids created by Moreau.
Oh, cool.
And in one of the latter arcs of Eric Powell's The Goon series, the book and its themes play a big role in a character's mental breakdown.
Lewis Davies writes, Alan Moore has Moreau as a character in his League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, where he is responsible for creating various anthropomorphized Victorian and Edwardian animal characters, such as Rupert Bear, Peter Rabbit, and Mr. Toad from Wind and the Willows.
All right, yeah.
I forgot about that, but so interesting. Moore links the story with Darwinism, and he argues that only after Darwin's ideas spread do you get animal stories where animals are fully humanized and wear full human clothes, live in human houses, etc., and that this is the anxiety about humanity existing on a continuity with animals rather than as some unique, distinct form. Not only fear of degeneration, but also them being far closer to us than we might think. I don't know about that. I mean, you've got animal human hybrid characters in mythology.
Oh, yeah. Tons. If Moore did say that, maybe he was just talking more about Western culture.
Right, sure. Jason of the K writes, Guardians of the Galaxy 3 borrows heavily from Dr. Moreau. I feel like the can I mold flesh to make it something new idea is a timeless concept, even more so in today's world of advanced cosmetic surgery and even physical transformations with larynx and uterus transplants, as well as gender reassignment surgery. How much does physical change relate to mental or emotional change? Can one drive the other, or is it always a fleeting effect? Is the only thing separating man from dog an opposable thumb and a voice box? Is enough surgery all it takes to be a Kardashian? Will I succeed when so many others try and fail?
Yeah, man, I don't know. It's interesting to think about, you know, definitions. I mean, that's our words. When somebody says things, speaking of, you know, a dog or a human, what do those things actually mean to somebody? And when you start breaking everything down, it's not binary. Nothing is ever binary. There's always exceptions. There's always things that will exist outside those definitions that still somehow fit, or we have to decide at some point when they do fit within.
Yeah, they're all operational definitions. I mean, I think of us as life forms on a continuity. You know, we're related to everything, and, you know, we're all stardust, man. You know, but other people are very offended to think that they might have a relation with the animal kingdom or objects or anything like that. So,
yeah, our good old friend Thomas Rawlings writes, great episode as ever. Wanted to add a note regarding evolution and de-evolution. That idea that the evolution path was a tree, and as organisms got more complex, they got better/higher, is a very human interpretation of evolution and very much of the age of the story it was written in, as you noted. The goal of a species is to procreate to survive, so becoming more complex is just a strategy to achieve that. A virus, a very simple organism by comparison to us, but also very complex in its own right, is very, very successful in evolutionary terms, numbering countless forms and populations here on Earth whose numbers dwarf us sapiens. So the idea that there are higher or lower beings in evolutionary terms is just not how nature works. Only how we interpret nature and our place within it. For example, Neanderthals, in the past considered a lower or more primitive form of hominid, lasted for around 450,000 years, whereas Homo sapiens were around for 350,000 years. So before we consider ourselves better than them, we've got to last around 100,000 years more. Interesting, too, is that Darwin realized humans were subject to the same process as all other creatures, but really held back in going too far here, as he knew already that his ideas were hard to take for a Victorian society, which helped to further the idea that somehow us humans were the peak of the process. Cosmic horror warning, We're not, and the full realization of evolution's implications is that every species that is born is also destined to die, us included.
You can make the argument, you know, it's an ant's world and we're just living in it.
Yeah.
Or single cell organisms. Definitely. Mm-hmm. Colm Kearns writes, quote, "There are vocal qualities peculiar to men and vocal qualities peculiar to beasts. And it is terrible to hear the one when the source should yield the other." Our man HP was right on the money with that one. And this story, and particularly Andrew's reading of it, really gets under the skin with this primal nature transgressing horror.
Graham Eberhardt writes, "I will forevermore ask myself, does it look like a dog cooked it before every meal?" Thanks, Chad.
By the way, I just finished a remix for Graham's band, Mayhem Lettuce. Like,
all right.
Literally just finished it before we jumped on to record this. I think it'll be out in July. They're doing a remix project, but nice. We'll let you know. It was a lot of
Please
fun.
Please do. And that gets us to feedback 11, application of slacks. The Last Human in Ismuth writes, "Happy birthday, Chris. When I heard you say welcome to your 50s, it hit me right in the chest. I remember you guys talking about your impending 40s and realized just how long I've really been listening to you all. Also, I too sing Revelations in Black." When I first saw the title for The Werewolf and the Vampire, I immediately sang it in my head like the opening of Bullet with Butterfly Wings in Chad's voice.
Well, that's good to hear. Hopefully people also sang Application of Slacks when they saw the title of this. In closing the loop on the public bathroom comment, we were taken to task for criticizing people for not showering very often.
Oh, right, yes.
Mr. Zeal clarified, "Sorry not to make my point clearly about past bath habits as mentioned in Robert Aikman. It just felt a bit like you were ragging my long-dead grandparents is all. But..." And it links out to a History of Bathrooms article. That's actually what we were asking for. Mm-hmm. And from that article, quotes, "In the United States of America, sewerage systems also began to be installed in major cities such as Chicago in the 1850s. In parts of Britain, the industrial poor and lower classes housed in densely populated tenement buildings had to share a very limited allocation of bathrooms, baths, and toilets for many decades to come. Once freshwater plumbing became widely available, showers became linked into it and stopped recycling dirty rinse water as the earlier ones had done."
Mm-hmm.
"This means that before, a shower would have just run the same shower water over you repeatedly. So the same water might have been used by a whole family or house of lodgers? Yikes."
Yeah, I know about this. There's an older guy who was telling me, I mean, he's in his 70s, mm-hmm. about how when he was a kid, they filled the bath and then the whole family took turns using the same bath water.
Oh boy. Up until the late 1960s, many new UK houses were still built without bathrooms, so folks would have to get a galvanized metal tub and set it up in the kitchen or scullery and then heat a whole lot of water up laboriously and expensively in order to take a bath.
Mm-hmm.
In the 60s, I think, my grandfather was up to date enough to build a permanent bath into the family kitchen and install an electric water heater near it to make the process easier. Wow. If you wander around modern London, you will find that many swimming pools and sports/leisure centers were originally bathhouses, like in ancient Rome, sort of, where you could go and pay to enjoy a nice, hot, deep bath in private. Well, there you go.
Amazing.
We're very lucky to live in the modern age.
Jim Cannon writes, "Oh, I wouldn't say I liked Quag Keep. I just said that I read it and that it's weird. It's the first novel based on Dungeons & Dragons to be published, although Norton, I believe, only ever sat in on one game session with Gygax and never actually played the game. She thought it was cool enough to springboard a whole novel out of it. I'm not surprised Chris couldn't get far." I did know that she didn't actually play D&D when I was reading it. She sat in on a session, but she was interested in it.
Obviously.
Jim goes on to write, "Nowadays, when officially licensed D&D novels exist, and even the majority of current writers today have slung dice at least once in their lives, yes, even George R.R. Martin, we can forget that there was a time when the fantasy industry influenced the makers of D&D instead of D&D inspiring much of the fantasy industry.
Yeah.
Quag Keep is, I think, an important link on that chain of evolution, but I couldn't honestly urge anyone to read it unless they're a big appendix and nerd like me."
It's funny that Jim would infer that we're surprised that George R.R. Martin played Dungeons & Dragons. Like, I see that guy on a talk show, I'm like, he knows what a D20 is. The Island of Dr. Moreau, Part 3. Let's talk about some comments from that episode. Ethan Cordray writes, "I guess I was wrong about the novel not having a cosmic horror element. I'd just forgotten it. But it comes through really strongly in this section, both in Moreau's theological musings and in Prendick's expression of mechanistic alienation. The latter sounds like it could come straight from H.P. Lovecraft or Thomas Ligotti, imagining that human consciousness and civilization are the real aberrations amid an incomprehensible universe of fate, instinct, and violence. Gosh, I really think this might be the greatest horror novel of all time.
Jim Cannon writes, "So I have been reading this book along with you, something I do not usually do. But having failed to read this once, I figured I would give it another go. Of course, you don't advertise where the breaks will be, and I have no idea how you're going to squeeze in what's left into just one more episode. So I have leapfrogged past you every week. It's quite an amazing book. So many ideas and cruelties packed into its pages. This is the sequel to Frankenstein I have been looking for and unable to find. And it's been right there all this time."
Going bookstore to bookstore. Do you guys got a sequel to Frankenstein? No.
Yeah, you know, we record our shows in advance. So putting in what chapters we will cover wouldn't really be much of a problem for us.
Yeah.
It didn't occur to me to do this, but in the next big book that we cover, I think we will. And that book will be Eat, Pray, Love.
First I'm hearing of it. I'm so excited. Ben A. writes, "I am thoroughly enjoying your coverage of Dr. Moreau. For what it's worth, whenever I teach my evolutionary biology course to anthropology students, the question about human-chimpanzee hybrids comes up. And no, not because I bring it up. The whole sordid history you all discuss is actually well-known in evolutionary circles, and thankfully, that highly unethical series of events never happened. But attempts to hybridize humans with other apes is not likely to produce viable offspring. For one, there are probably barriers that prevent eggs and sperm from being able to merge. This is called a prezygotic barrier. In addition, there is a major chromosomal mismatch between humans and chimps. Two of the chromosomes in chimpanzees fused together somewhere along the human lineage that split from our common ancestor. This may cause fundamental developmental problems even if sperm and egg can fertilize. It's not always a terminal problem, since horses and donkeys can produce sterile but viable offspring, mules and hinnies. This is a long way for me to confirm that Tim Burton must have used genetic engineering for those poor out-of-work ape hybrids." Yeah, he did.
Good callback, Ben.
He built on those ideas that allowed him to put scissors on Johnny Depp's hands.
He did. Christine McCann writes, "Interesting that you talked about rabbits eating their babies. Just this week, I learned that deer eat birds when they get a chance. Not only has it been caught on nest cams, but a Field and Stream article reports researchers in Canada trying to catch birds in mist nets only succeeded in providing an easy meal for the whitetails that ate the birds right out of the netting." Oh, God. "Appropriately, I learned this strange fact from a horror game called Scarlet Hollow, which seems like something weird fiction fans would enjoy."
Do you know that game?
No, I don't. That does
Scarlet
sound really...
That Hollow.
Scarlet Hollow. I'll have to check that out.
Robert Poyton writes, "Actually, speaking as one born just on the edge of hearing for Bow Bells, Chad wasn't far off with Cockney." I think I said it came from Chicken Men or something like that. "The earliest recorded use is 1362 in William Langland's Piers Plowman, where it is used to mean a small misshapen egg from Middle English coken plus E, a cock's egg. So there was some kind of chicken language in the background of that. Mm-hmm. However, the current meaning is said to come from its rural use as a pejorative term for effeminate town dwellers. The Reeve's Tale of Chaucer's The Canterbury Tales has a cockney as a child tenderly brought up and by extension an effeminate fellow or a milksop. By 1600, this meaning of cockney was being particularly associated with the Bow Bells area. Hence, anyone born within the sound of Bow Bells is said to be a cockney, though the term is now more widely used for anyone from the East End of London."
Yeah.
"Not Dick Van Dyke, though, LOL." It's funny. When I think of cockney, I just think of a tough guy. Maybe I've watched too many episodes of EastEnders or something. But
well, things change, man. That's the thing with language that people just don't get, is that it changes constantly.
Yeah.
Get with it, people. The Island of Dr. Moreau, Part 4. Illegal Structures writes, "To be honest, I've always dismissed Wells as purveyor of simple boys, proto-pulp yarns. But based on your coverage of Moreau, I can see that he had much more to offer. I was shocked and intrigued to hear just how depressing and gross this novel actually is, and how it partakes in the early weird fiction tradition. In fact, I wonder if it might owe a debt to Mackin's Great God Pan, which came out a few years earlier to Moreau, and caused a sensation with its treatment of unspeakable transformations. As you mentioned in an old H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast episode, Wells and Mackin were hired to contribute stories to a short-lived publication called The Unicorn. Although none of their stories appeared together in print, doubtless they were aware of each other's work. It's curious to consider what kind of cross-pollinations had taken place between Mackin and Wells, especially since they are rarely mentioned together, at least as far as I'm aware. Perhaps in the future you will consider covering Mackin's The Terror, which has a reportage style and a scientific sensibility similar to Wells. Keep up the great work, lads. Aww.
David Halstead writes, "He who makes a beast of himself gets rid of the pain of being a man." And that's a quote from Samuel Johnson from 1809. He says, I think Wells may have been referencing this famous quote. Undoubtedly.
Yeah.
Jason Thompson writes, "I used to love that Penn and Teller quote about religion." This is, you remember you quoted him saying, "Oh, yes. I murder as much as I want," which is never. Mm-hmm. "But I love it less lately, so here's my contrary take. I think the idea that quote-unquote normal people would never do horrible things is a little too comforting and not entirely true. Mm-hmm. I think most people have some level of antisocial urges, and we restrain them either from empathy, can't do that to another person, or fear of punishment. If I post that on Twitter, I'll lose my job. In either case, self-control keeps people from making the impulsive choice, and when self-control is impaired, whether from drugs and alcohol or mental illness, people's moral boundaries are eroded. I get what Teller is mocking in the original quote, the equally bad idea that only religion keeps us from savagery. But today it feels a little smug to me to proclaim that I and other cool people am naturally good and anyone who does bad things is naturally evil. The world is complicated and the urge to draw a clear line between goodies and baddies can itself lead to bad places."
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I don't think it's a good argument. It's sort of a comment for effect. That's well said. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say so too. And unfortunately, there are lots of people out there that do bad things. Even with social constrictions being in place, they still manage to do terrible things to other human beings and animals and whatnot. That gets us to extra credit. Film adaptations of The Island of Dr. Moreau. One passionate advocate for cat-based space travel, CBST, writes, "This is a complex topic, not well suited for a comment post. Apologies for any nuance skipped, poorly explained, or otherwise unclear. The idea of men being more commonly sacrificed or devalued in terms of lives and harm is an interesting one because it can be used to see the inconsistencies among men's rights groups. This concept called disposable male slash men is exactly as you describe it. Society and media often does not view men's lives as important as women's lives. However, where men's rights groups go wrong, deliberately due to faulty logic or due to internal bias, is presuming that women slash feminism is to blame for this. This is absurd, and this movie is a perfect example. Women in general were probably not major decision makers for films in the 1930s, so the idea that feminism was driving this trope is hard to believe. If we give these men the benefit of the doubt, it may be a result of a misunderstanding of the goals of feminism. If one views feminism as making things good for women, then one can see how this might fit. But in reality, feminism is of course about making things equal for women and all people slash genders, ideally, but TERFs are another topic for another day. Summarizing, yes, historically men are expected to go off and die more than women. Harm toward men in media is often considered more acceptable than towards women, etc. However, women are not the ones driving this. Other men are. Anti-feminism is. Patriarchy is. Women aren't the ones making decisions about violence towards men in movies, generally. Women aren't the ones making decisions about sending men off to war. Women aren't the ones making decisions to put men in prison or subject them to violence within prison. Women are driving increased suicide rates among men, etc. This is true of a lot of men's rights issues. The issues are often real, but for any number of reasons, they erroneously attribute the cause of these problems to women slash feminism. When the call is coming from inside the house, not that violence towards women in media is uncommon, just that it's often used to signal this guy hitting this woman is a bad guy, or as you point out, making dog boys is fine, but dog girls?
Well, yeah, those in power benefit when those they objectify war with one another, right? So, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I my argument was just that nobody should be devalued of either gender.
Yeah, of course.
Stacey Schumacher writes, "There's a kind of adaptation you missed. Batman, the animated series, did an episode called Tiger, Tiger, had a Panther Man, and Selina Kyle turned into a Catwoman, a real Catwoman. Serum, thankfully, not surgery."
Whoa.
Ian O'Toole writes, "Cannot agree with Chad enough that everyone should watch The Letter. Betty Davis's entrance in that film is an all-timer." Oh, good. Yeah, it's a really good movie. I think folks should check it out. Ethan Cordray writes, "It sounds like the film world is overdue for a new adaptation. I know you guys aren't really looking for Hollywood work nowadays, but maybe this pitch will change your minds. Moreau versus Manimal."
Whoa.
Again, I'm so surprised we barely, if at all, brought up Manimal over the month we were covering this.
Yeah.
We need to remedy that. So our extra credit episode this month is going to be on Manimal, and it's the greatest episode ever. We've been looking forward to this one for so long.
Oh, God. It does not disappoint on the rewatch.
Oh, you watched it already?
Oh, yeah. You bet. I forgot how many rad things are in that episode.
Breath of the Dragon, yeah. Oh, so by the way, we had a comment from Sludgecrawler that said, sorry to be blunt, but are these filmed and unedited shows that much easier to produce and put out? Is that why you're doing this? Talking about the extra credit episodes,
yes,
which we have been doing live on video. Yes, it does save us time because we take a lot of care on our audio episodes, editing them and improving the quality.
Yep.
And we thought, what if we did one every month where we didn't have to do that so much? But it seems after we've just run a little survey that folks aren't even really watching the video. And I can understand why, because it's just talking heads.
Yeah.
So we're going to revert back to audio only and maybe just take an approach of light editing. It's real tough for us to get these six episodes out every month at the quality we want. You know, we used to do four. So we love doing this one and we love doing the extra credit, but we're trying to save ourselves some time. We're going to go back to audio only for this Manimal Breath of the Dragon one. Oh. We might do a video component though, because you really got to see some.
Oh my God.
Some of these scenes. So even though we don't really have the rights to do it, I might just put up a quick
clip reel. I think legally speaking, if you're discussing something, you're allowed to show clips of the thing that you're discussing. I mean, there's so many YouTube things that are based around that premise.
Yeah, that's true. Well, this would be just a straight highlights reel of the stuff that you would not believe in this awesome episode of Manimal. So look forward to that before the end of the month. This has been our feedback show. Guys, thanks for hanging out with us for that whole month. It was really fun.
Yeah.
Doing the Island of Dr. Moreau. For now, that's all we got. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories,
the feedback episode.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.